Hello and welcome to When the Grid Falls, an interview and essay podcast. Today I'll be in conversation with Gregory Neely of Forge Media and Design. Greg is one of the founding principals of Forge Media and Design, a highly interdisciplinary and forward-thinking design firm. Greg and I met at the 2014 IDEX Canada Design and Architecture Conference in Toronto, where he and another Forge principal gave a seminar entitled The Intersection of UX and Architecture in Wayfinding. Hi, Greg. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Could you tell us what is Forge and what kind of work does your company specialize in?
Well, that's always been a bit of a challenge for us to truly define who we are, because we are so multidisciplinary and we have some really remarkable people that are experts and leaders in a lot of different areas, including architecture, industrial design, software, web and mobile development, interaction, user experience design, motion graphics, physical technology, and strategy. So it covers the whole gamut. But what we've come to describe ourselves is a digital, physical, multidisciplinary design agency that is focused on user experience and audience engagement at the intersection of digital and physical environments.
Okay. Was that always the impetus behind?
The firm evolved. We started very much as a more you could call it traditional communication design firm. One of the things about Forge that I think had a massive impact on its evolution was how it started. And it started with three principals with three very, very different backgrounds. You had myself that came from a background of essentially signage and wayfinding exhibits, essentially designing for physical environments, which is sometimes called environmental graphic design. You had the other principal who was at the IDEX presentation, who actually has a background originally before he got into design. He was a stock trader and a banker in Switzerland, but he found that he wanted to design instead. His background was in a lot of corporate communications, a lot of product development, product naming, product branding, and marketing products and services on the corporate side. And then we had the third principal and partner who was a filmmaker. And his background was in film and video, but it was also in interactive media. It was also his primary focus is in visual storytelling. So the three of us working together formed a really interesting dynamic. And while we started as a firm that was originally going to pursue doing marketing and communications for entertainment industry, you know, CD covers and film posters and marketing and all of that side of things, we found that there was no money in it, for one.
That's good to know.
We found out there was absolutely no, they'll want, you know, there's opportunities to do cool stuff, but they don't want to pay for it. We're based in Toronto. Maybe in Los Angeles would be a different story, but it's certainly in Toronto. And out of those three backgrounds, projects started to come to the fore just through our relationships. So we had a major office tower in Toronto through a relationship that I had with an architect that was very, very early in the firm's history. We had a major website, SearsTravel.ca, we relaunched right at the beginning of the firm, which came from a relationship from some work that myself and the filmmaker were doing previously. And we had some very interesting work coming out of the straight design communication side. But that intersection of digital and physical environments evolved primarily out of the fact that we had a strong basis in designing for environments, so signage, exhibits, that type of thing, and also our interest in innovation and interactive experience and interactivity. And very early on in the firm's history, we got an opportunity to design a whole series of technology and interactive elements for a sales center for a condo development. So there was display components, interactive components, and also ambient components that use technology, which also came out of a bit of a happenstance, you could say. in terms of the opportunity presenting itself. We pulled it together and brought some other partners on that filled the gaps that we had at the time, and it was extremely successful. But as we were doing all of these projects early on, where we're looking at signage programs and we're looking at, touch screens so you can see information about a condo development and things like that, what we really came to focus on, that it was really about the end user experience. It was really about the end result. It wasn't about the thing we were designing or the thing we were making. To be successful, we needed to think about who our audience was and what our goals were in terms of the audience side. And that thinking, continued to evolve and became more and more of a centerpiece. It also started to become the central core that connected all the different things we do. It's not about the various different media that we work in, whether it's a piece of motion graphic, a exhibit piece, or a donor wall, or a website. We're really designing a result. And we started to use that narrative when we talked to clients and introducing ourselves where our focus was. And that's where that focus on user experience and audience engagement came from. And then as architecture is evolving, as the design of physical spaces are evolving, technology is becoming a much, much more significant part every day. And we were right on the beginning of that curve as that was starting to happen. And it's really great to see that it's starting to turn in a pretty significant way away from technology solutions in an environment which was owned by the AV industry. We've seen screens in spaces for a long, long time. But that's not what it's about. That was just the vehicle, and this idea of making it integrated and seamless and essentially pieces of content and information that is to be dynamic and responsive to the user, that is integral to the physical environment that they are interacting with. That's where that focus evolved from and continues to evolve and find more and more opportunities to present that idea as a powerful solution when people are thinking about physical environments that people are interacting with and working in. But I don't want to focus too much on the physical environment, and that's why I say the intersection of digital and physical environments, because it's also extremely important in a pure website. When you're designing even a website that exists entirely in the digital space, you're still building an environment. You're still building an experience that you have to understand your audience and have a goal of what are you really trying to achieve after that person leaves that website. What is the impression they're left? What information are they left with? What is that end experience that you're trying to achieve? And how do you create something that facilitates that and really stay focused on that? And one of the key things about that is also honing and really prioritizing and all along the way making decisions of what not to do and what's not important. Steve Jobs is always very, very good at that. That was his thing. He'd look at a range of 30 things that the various different groups at Apple wanted to pursue, and he'd pick three.
It sounds like that focus on end result has been a great source of adaptability. Mm-hmm. Just in researching, you guys were founded in 2005.
Yes.
That predates the iPhone.
Yes.
That predates this huge ubiquity.
Yes.
Of touch interfaces.
Yes.
Good choice. Because I can see that I would imagine many firms not being able to make that transition if they're from a more traditional background tied to certain mediums.
Yeah, and that was the thing. We've never tied ourselves to a medium, and we have a really, really strong culture of innovation. When we're faced with a challenge and an opportunity, we dig deep into the why. And we're always looking for the best possible way to respond to the why, in often ways the client hasn't even imagined or thought about. I mean, they may often will have a notional idea that as this especially happens with interior designers. Well, we have this retail space and we're creating this kind of brand experience. And a good example is the Mural project. And we want to have this major feature as part of the retail space that kind of has this visual illuminated cascade of light, like a visual. And we need to roll it out over multiple stores, and we need you guys to figure it out. So and then that project, they literally, all they gave us was a tear sheet from an interior design magazine that had a bathroom wall with this kind of visual white texture cascading down. They say kind of like that, but it's got to move and be dynamic. And it also can't cost much because it's going to be a rollout. So this is not an uncommon kind of challenge that we get. We get a client that comes to us and they think they know what they want, or they have a very undefined idea of what they want. And we have since the beginning, we've always taken the attitude, how do we best solve this problem? Forget about what are the tools and media and all of that. Those have to serve the solution. It's a good point you made and a good observation. And that's what we have done and we continue to do. And we invest in a lot of time and effort internally in exploring and keeping abreast of all of the stuff that's coming along, all of the different technology. No, I shouldn't say all. The technologies that we see that could be valuable tools. And we'll never make a decision, well, we'll do it this way because we know how to do it that way. There's many, many projects, and maybe, I don't know, widely this should be published, but when we start the project, we have no idea, clear idea, how we're going to solve, to address the challenge when we start the project. But we know because of our skill sets, because of our pursuit of innovation, because of just the way we work and what we can bring to the table, that we can figure it out, that we have the resources to figure out, whether the resources are entirely internally, which as time goes on has become more and more and more the case. In the early days, when it was just three of us or four of us, we had to bring in other resources. I mean, for instance, in the Mural project, we brought in an electronics engineer, and what we ended up deciding was that the solution for the Mural, if you can see it on our website, the solution for the Mural project to be cost-effective, to be flexible, to be able to integrate into the space, and to do most effectively just what we needed it to do and not a thousand other things, we needed to make it custom. So we had it absolutely custom designed. The Mural cascading lights are custom circuit boards that clip together with connectors, a lot like Lego, with controllers on each, and then the controllers are all connected together. And through algorithmic programming, that's how we create that entirely random visual cascade. But those circuit boards were all designed from scratch. Obviously, they're all the same, but they were designed from scratch by this electronics engineer who we brought on to do this. And that was far more cost effective than anything we could buy from a supplier. And we had them manufactured. There's a company in Scarborough that manufactured them for us. And that was the best solution. And that's a very good example. The interesting thing about the person who designed the circuit boards, he was retired and doing his own thing, but he was the individual who led the primary research that developed terrain following radar for NATO back in the 70s. So
sounds like a good person to have on your
very
team.
Very smart guy. I won't give you his name, though.
You've been practicing throughout the field of design for about 20 years.
Yes.
What has been the biggest change you've seen over those 20 years?
Wow.
Big question. But...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not one of the designers. Since I started practicing in 95, I'm not one of the designers that started in the world before, you know, the Mac. and moved into the Mac. From day one, I was working on computers. So it's definitely not that. And that's a common one for people who have about 30 years experience. I would say one huge change is the democratization of essentially the democratization of content and information. The fact that it's the rise of the user. It's the fact that the end user now drives so much because collectively they have incredible power to shape and change things. The VP of marketing at any corporation no longer controls their brand. All they can do is establish goals and objectives of what they want their brand to be. And they can employ certain strategies to try to put the elements out there that support who they want their brand to be. But if the users of the product or service, if the users that experience that company or organization do not support or align with those strategies and with those goals and objectives, they win. They will change it because the brand is the end reputation of that organization. It's what people think of them. That's really what the brand is. And I think that's been a massive change that I've seen in the last 20 years. Because when I started in design in 95, it was still very much top down. You know, you had your VP marketing and your director of marketing, and they put the stuff out. You know, in 95, of course, we had email and internet and all of those things, but it was very rudimentary. There was no social media. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, everything was very much still of kind of a broadcast mentality. It's just and internet was a secondary aspect of that. It was still all about putting out the marketing communications that told the story. And the story that you told was essentially taken as, I mean, to different levels, but that's what it was. You know, the brand was what it was because you said it was. Mm-hmm. That has massively changed. So now, and I think there's still a lot of executives out there that may be still getting their head around this. They don't have control anymore. They have to shape, they have to massage, they have to take, you know, put in those ingredients and those strategies, those elements to move their audience in the direction they want them to move. So that's been very interesting. And that's been a big part of the rise of the user. And out of that, and I talked about in IDEX, is the changes, at least from our perspective, were design has moved from the tangible to the intangible. The thing is the vehicle, but it's not what the primary design focus is. It is still simply a means to an end. We're much more, it was the end. It was the thing. It was what our focus is. What is that thing to tell that story? And that's not what it's about anymore. It's much more about who is our audience and what is it we want them to get out of this piece of interaction? What are we trying to shape in their minds? And that's a subtle but a pretty big change. So I think that's been a big part of it. And obviously just the explosion of the online space as the primary marketing tool. I mean, when I started in 95, there was still a lot of firms that had massive business in print and printed communications. And that was still the primary marketing dollars. And you had these huge annual reports. And the annual report for a public corporation was the primary marketing document of the year. And they spent a huge amount of money. And there was significant amount of work in the whole marketing front end of the annual report and telling that story and, you know, all of that went into that. Massive dollars. In fact, there were design firms in the city. Their entire business was annual reports. Mm-hmm. That's mostly gone now. And primary marketing dollars are in the digital space. And that's been a massive revolution. Now there are still great, there's still a printing industry out there and there's still a place for printing, but in terms of where the push is, where the primary focus is, it's definitely gone from, and again, the tangible, the thing, the printed piece, to the intangible. So I, that would be the primary ways that I've seen it change. And it's been a massive revolution. I mean, there, I'm sure there's designers that have been working for 30 years or 10 years more than me that just don't even recognize their own industry. Other than the fact, the one thing that has always still been the same, and even though what we're talking about, we're designing user experience focused or whatever, it's the design thinking. And that's what good designers learn in school, is how to solve a problem in that process of design thinking. Because that, that crosses mediums, it crosses a whole range of things, because that, as long as you continually and consistently apply that process of design thinking, you can solve these problems, even though you're working in a completely different world. It's just different data inputs.
As a design firm, you're capable of delivering a powerful and impactful experience to an audience for a client. What ethical responsibilities does this come with?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain clients and projects that we will decline. We're very cognizant with our clients about visually lying. We will challenge our clients, and we will make the strong argument, and especially in this day and age, you just can't get away with that. It's just going to hurt them in the end anyway, because the user, with the democratization of content and information, and you know, the fact that marketing departments can't even control their brand anymore. It's the end user that controls their brand, because they decide what the reputation of that company is, not them. All they can do is try to shape it, but they don't have control. So to be honest, it's gotten, I'd say, much easier than it probably was 20 years ago to make those, to face those challenges and deal with those kind of decisions. But yeah, there is a responsibility when you're creating something for an audience. It's got to be authentic. And if it's not, it looks bad on you and it looks bad on the client, especially in this day and age. So I agree. There is an important responsibility. And fortunately, we have so far not been faced with a situation where it's put us in a difficult spot.
Okay. Yeah, because I think I've heard that there can be a bit of a disregard for the thing you're actually marketing, because you're just doing your part of the machine.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things you have to do is, and this is, comes with establishing trust with your clients, is you've got to be able to communicate with them in terms of your understanding of their goals and objectives, and the ultimate goals and objectives. They've hired you for your expertise. And you need to be able to communicate that in a way that they understand that your opinion is not simply a subjective opinion based on the fact that you want something to be blue, for instance, because you want it to be. You are as much on their side as a business consultant, a strategic consultant. You're trying to solve their problem. You're trying to bring a perspective that they've hired you to bring. And one of the things I talk about with students is the single most important skill and ability to be successful in design, and I would argue almost any profession, is your ability to communicate. It's not your creative ability. It's not your... I mean, all of, you know, your creativity, your ability to express things in drawings, your ideas, your ability to manage, execute, all of that stuff. That's all a baseline. Your single most important element that will lead to success is your ability to communicate, your ability to speak, your ability to write, and your ability to argue in a constructive way, a clear point of view, in a way that communicates effectively why you are making this recommendation and why you're suggesting to do this, that goes far beyond simply the subjective. It's always got to come back to, what are we trying to achieve? Is this going to achieve it? You know, for instance, we are concerned that this element is going to detract from your ultimate goal, and here is why. So quite frankly, there's a lot of similarity in design in terms of working with clients to really address their challenges as there is with a lawyer arguing a case in a courtroom. You've got to have your facts. You've got to do your homework. You got to have compelling arguments of why you're making the case you're making. And you've also got to recognize, you got to pick the hill you're going to die on. But if you can build a trust with the client that you're not simply there to draw these pictures for them or to stylize this or that, if we're really looking at what design is at its core, and that's solving problems, if you can establish trust in your client that that's what you're there to do, you're there to make their life better, you're there to make them look good, and you're there to actually advance the interests of the organization that you've been hired to work with.
Going back to wayfinding, in the example that you brought up, like a hospital, where the user experience you provide has a real tangible result. It can affect the efficiency of the workers there to provide care. How exactly are designers held accountable? Say in the example of very poor wayfinding in a hospital or something that costs critical time. Is there a system of accountability, or is it just very open
right now?
No,
there really isn't a system of accountability. One of the things that is slowly changing with wayfinding, fortunately, is the fact that I would say the vast majority of the good firms that know what they're doing do understand this. The wayfinding is not just signage.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, you had an architect who would design a building. And they would design the building based on functional requirements, operational requirements, block diagrams. You know, well, we need emergency in this proximity to this department, and we need to organize it this way because our system, all of that, right? So it's entirely very much about clinical and operational servicing. And then the building was designed around that. And of course, there was still the design aspect and the architectural vision, but it was really driven by that. And then after all that would happen, they come in and hire a wayfinding consultant. Okay, so we need a wayfinding system so people can find their way around. Based on your reaction, you understand where that leads. That leads to a whole bunch of just trying to direct people around probably what is usually a very complex environment after the fact, and there's been no thought in terms of really the user. So what is starting to happen in terms of thinking about wayfinding as a user experience, and this is what we push, is how do you design a hospital, for instance, with all of these, you still have to serve the operational clinical requirements, but thinking about the different personas and the different users and how can we elevate the hospital experience? Because hospital experiences are, by their nature, negative as a baseline. Nobody really wants to be there. So you're already starting way below zero. So so what can be done? Now, I don't have any good examples yet of where this has been done. I think the thinking is starting to open up. It's still often very much a case of catch up, where you have, catching up in terms of after the fact, where you've got a design building and then you're putting in signs and you end up often with a lot of too much signage and you get a bit of diminishing returns. And then that creates confusion and greater anxiety and all of that. There's always a focus with hospital wayfinding design, you know, how do we minimize anxiety? The way I think we're really going to do that is design hospitals from the user experience perspective and thinking about all of the different personas and experience maps of the different people using it and thinking about that. And when we were thinking about users, we're not just thinking about the visitors. We're thinking about the staff. You know, we're thinking about the operational, the staff elements, the user. But thinking about that first, I think, is how it can be done better. But I'm not sure when we're going to get to a point where we're actually doing that. But at least we can see where it should be going.
The touchscreen is currently the go-to for interactive interfaces, mm-hmm. as it's the most versatile and ubiquitous option so far. Mm-hmm. Though it's served us well, how would you advise we go further in creating an interactive and immersive experience?
Yeah, that's one of the questions, isn't it? You know, everything has its purpose. I don't think touchscreens are going away anytime soon. There's been a lot of exploration in wearable technologies. Google obviously came out with their Google Glass, which was a PR disaster because anybody who wore it looked ridiculous. And they forgot. I don't know if they forgot. I mean, at Google Glass, I have to couch that comment. People have to understand Google Glass was a huge experiment, and it was never meant as anything more than an experiment. It was something that they came up with, and they'd throw it out there. At least this is my understanding, and see what would happen. Mm-hmm. So I never saw Google Glass as considered to be a finished, you know, widespread retail product for the mainstream. But the idea of fully wearable technology is very interesting if it can get to a point where your typical set of glasses that you wear could project content into the environment you're experiencing. That would be an incredibly immersive experience, also incredibly customizable, because you may only want, just like you have filters, you know, you'll see this on a number of websites now that, you know, can work very successfully. We have a lot of content, and then you can filter and organize that content by different criteria. Mm-hmm. Well, imagine if you could, through wearable technology that was properly designed for a great user experience. So literally something like, I don't know if you wear glasses or not, your standard set of glasses, not like Google Glass, and not something where it has like a little box mini screen that you're sort of looking at in your eye. I mean, something that truly projects content into your field of view in the glass. That could be incredibly powerful. And then you could determine, based on even the environment, I mean, and so many different factors, what information that you want added to your visual perspective, or nothing. Or not. And I think that would be a very, very exciting thing that would change the world in significant ways. Because if we remember, a lot of what we're interested in pursuing is using technology to really serve a purpose and not necessarily just the sake of its own experience, right? There's so much out there, and it's cool and it's fun, but it's very short-lived and it's very ephemeral, and it's it has its place, but there's so much opportunity. If we think about why do we need or use technology for conveying information, and that's primarily because we want information to be changeable and responsive to the user as much as possible in terms of their specific needs at the time, the environment they're in, the information they're looking for, all of that. If we didn't have that fluidity of different types of information people need at different times in different situations, then technology doesn't really serve a purpose because it's that fluidity. So if we could essentially allow people to access that information completely intuitively in their field of view as needed or wanted, I'd say that's where the future potentially is. But that would have a massive, massive impact on so much, because now when you're, for instance, going through a museum and you're looking at a museum exhibit, they could immerse you into, instead of having all these little panels, they could immerse you into a space. And depending on what you look at, you could receive data about it. You know, that whole little write-up and information, and you could go deeper and deeper into it or not. Wayfinding, it could be very, very powerful in wayfinding because it will find that sweet spot between orientation in terms of your physical environment, a landmarking, which comes from the physicality of an environment and the elements in the environment, as well as the layer of information that works with that to provide the information to help you find your way. So hospitals, transit hubs, museums, all those places, and even driving, the whole heads-up driving. If it could be done in a way that's highly purposeful, that's simple and effective and really focused on providing data to people who need it, want it, in a way that they need it and want it, that would be incredibly powerful without all of the other potential fluff that could come with it as well. But if it could be focused in that way, it could be really effective. I mean, part of the problem right now is you have the GPS on the mobile phones, which is great and useful and very, very important. However, I would argue that it is also massively detracted from ability for an average person to find their way in a city. Because what they've done is they've been driving, following the GPS and not looking at the world around them. So you take the GPS away and they're still lost. That's one of the struggles right now, is drawing almost too much attention to the electronic device, because the physical world around us is also incredibly important. So I think I kind of went off on a tangent a bit there. But that's where I see it potentially going. I'd like to see it go. But touch screens, all of the different ways we interact with technology will always have their place. A touch screen is very location-based in a lot of ways if it's in a physical environment. Touch screens are very good if you want a simple interface to explore lots of different kinds of information.
That issue you mentioned about people losing their understanding of how to navigate space and landmarks because of the outsourcing to the GPS, it's an argument that's existed for a long time. I think even in ancient Greece, there were concerns about the book and people not knowing things because of the book. Do you see that risk when we talk about something like Google Glass or the projector onto the glasses that you talk about? If that had wide adoption, do you see serious risks with that?
No. Actually, I see the what Google Glass was trying to do. Let's just assume it's done better, like I was talking about. I see it actually as solving that problem, because you are looking at the data in context to your physical environment. So now your brain is processing both at once. So instead of how many people have seen walking down the street staring at their phone, their brain is not processing the world around them. And that's really a problem. And I talk about in the IDEX presentation that the way we navigate and orient and interact with physical environments, the two groups of brain cells that were discovered, one collects landmarks and the other group of cells creates relationships between those landmarks, creating a sort of a grid structure. So you can't do that when you're walking down the street staring at a mobile phone. Now, if we could be walking down the street looking forward and we happen to want, you know, have data that is presented in our field of vision, it's now within the context of collecting that information. So that would be very, very powerful.
In video games and virtual environments, services like Google Street View, audiences are getting more and more exposure to spaces that they've never been to or they never can go to if it's fictional.
Yes.
How do you think this exposure might change our expectation of spaces around us? Huh. And also especially if you have that augmented reality technology, like an ideal Google Glass.
It's really funny. There's so many ways, and I'm not sure whether it's the chicken or the egg, but there's so many ways, quite frankly, where Star Trek has provided a very accurate view of our future. And I'm not sure if we're chasing Star Trek or if there was some precognition of where things were going back when they were conceiving of all this stuff. But the alignment is really quite remarkable. But quite frankly, the blur between reality and I don't want to use the word fantasy, but reality or what we want something to be is going to become blurred. Because we are rapidly getting to a point where we will be able to create entirely virtual environments that we can experience, like you say, Google Earth. But imagine Google Earth to a point where it really is like we're standing there. Mm-hmm. It's not that far off. So environments will be able to be presented how we wish them to be. It definitely is a blurring of a line, and I don't necessarily have a perspective and an answer what that actually means. It obviously creates challenges, opportunities, and dangers in terms of shaping our world, but it's definitely what's happening. I think, you know, what's amazing about Google Earth, which is that you can visit so many parts of the world without visiting, I think that has its own value in terms of shrinking the planet and giving us perspective of different parts of the world, things that we have never actually seen. We can at least get some perspective. The question is, where is that line going to be in terms of how accurate is what we see? And I guess it's going to be up to the people who own that content and own that information to govern the veracity of that information. But it's also interesting to think that we could create an experience, an environment of our own imagining.
This is a topic of a lot of science fiction, but say with the example of augmented reality. In that case, we're still interacting with the space around us. So people could continue doing productive jobs.
Yes.
Whereas a fear that shows up often in science fiction is people preferring the virtual and then heading off in that direction.
Yes. Yeah, so yes, you could have completely virtual environments that people may decide they want to get lost in, but that's also going to create a desire for something very real and tangible and authentic, because there's always a counterpoint. The other thing, though, is there is also an opportunity to be able to create worlds for us to experience, even in a short term, of our own choosing, which is a very powerful creative outlet that could then inspire and bring things back in terms of ideas and pursuits that could have a big impact on our real world as well in terms of people's ideas to solve challenges, problems, our ability to simulate situations and experiment with scenarios in a very experiential way is very interesting to me, because that's one of the ways that we figure out what works and what doesn't. And there's so much in life where the actual answer to solve or address a problem or a challenge can be incredibly counterintuitive. And the only way to really test that is to try it. But that takes a big leap of faith to try it for real, because it seems like what you're going to do is the exact opposite of what you should be doing. But oftentimes that's what works.
The technologies that we have available today, like engines that track trends from users,
mm-hmm.
How well do you think they've been exploited so far? How good has our imagination been?
That's a bit of a double-edged sword, because the whole tracking of users has opened up a massive amount of privacy concern with this question of metadata. And metadata is the method or context in terms of what the data comes from. So for instance, in an email, the actual text in the email, the message is the data, you know, who the email is from, when it was sent, you know, all of those things are the metadata. That is a very difficult question in terms of how well is imagination. I guess the answer is really contextual. It depends on what we're trying to do. We just have to be very, very careful that we are not crossing the line into manipulation. If we can stay focused on serving the user and making the user's experience better and more that have a greater value, then it can be helpful. But I think in a lot of cases, metadata so far in data has been utilized more in terms of the on the pure product marketing and sales. Like you'll see on websites, they'll keep sending you ads because you've gone to one thing and they're collecting data to track your habits and things, essentially for the idea of to sell you more. Which I understand why they're doing it. They're using it as a strategy to improve sales and things like that. And I know there's been a huge amount of pushback. I mean, Nordstrom really got their wrist slapped in their stores because they were tracking their customers to a huge level of granularity. And that's why Apple and a lot of the mobile devices stopped allowing MAC addresses to be used. In fact, Wi-Fi-based indoor positioning is dead pretty much now because of that, in terms of tracking people's habits and behaviors and what they were doing, what they're buying, and all of that stuff. So I'm not sure exactly how to answer this question. All I would say is I think the way it's been used is a little bit opportunistic so far in a lot of cases, and the way it should be used is a way to create value for the user and to really keep along the thinking that the technology and the information is to serve people, not the other way around. So that would be my perspective on this case. And in terms of specifics, it really is contextual. I think it could be very powerful in a museum. I think it could be very powerful in a hospital in terms of helping people, in terms of streamlining their experience and giving them, especially in a museum, a richer content experience in terms of their interests and things like that. But you have to be really careful you don't become invasive. It can't go any deeper. You know, what you want to do with that kind of information, that level of responsiveness, it's almost like you want to get to a point where it's like it would be if you go to a coffee shop or a restaurant on a regular basis and you have somebody who knows you and they know your order and they're familiar with you, and it's a comfort level, right? It's almost like a level of responsiveness because they know you and they're there to, you know, you come in and they give you what you want, and it's really, 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 really seamless. And it's that sense of familiarity. What you don't want to do is cross that line where it becomes invasive, if that makes sense. And I think we're still, the industry, especially data, like the Googles and all of that and the Facebooks, they're trying to figure out where that line is. I mean, the interesting...
They've ignored it first.
Well, they've completely ignored it at first, but now they're being forced to figure out where that line is. And I think, again, the audience is driving this. People don't want to be invaded. However, they do want information that's responsive to their needs. So I think we need to take it case by case, context by context, of what makes sense in a specific space. I mean, Facebook's a really good example. They really got their wrist slapped on that. But I mean, the funny thing that people have to remember about Facebook is, in Facebook, the users are the product.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Not the software. What Facebook is doing is they're selling the users to their clients.
So when you were talking before about that the user has the greatest influence now on what your brand actually is, do you see that coming back to bite them?
No, I think it has already. I think it's one of the things that's pushed them. And I mean, yes, they got into trouble with some regulatory, but that regulatory is also driven by the political establishment, which is driven by voters. But I think there is also a bit of a groundswell in terms of what people wanted to have public or not, and what people were comfortable with or not. I mean, Facebook has to, they live and die by the amount of people that are signed up for Facebook. I mean, quite literally Facebook is a massive, massive, with organization, millions and millions of users. However, all it would take to destroy Facebook, for in terms of what we know it as, if there was a mass number of people that deleted their accounts. That's very easy for users to do. You know, Facebook could be obliterated in the matter of a month if the users decided. It does live and die by its users, even though they are its product. Fortunately, Facebook provides a a platform that people have responded to because it allows them to connect with other people in the digital world and the physical world. It is the intersection of digital and physical in a way that is fun and compelling in something that they've responded to. So I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, unlike a company, say, you know, an IBM or an Apple, you couldn't destroy an IBM or an Apple in, you know, given a month or two. I mean, they have a massive infrastructure. All Facebook is, all they've got are all those accounts. If they all leave, there is no Facebook. So they're, I think they're very much driven by their audience, even though their audience are their product.
What advice would you give to somebody entering the design field that would hope to be as adaptable as yourself and your team has been?
Well, obviously a single individual is not going to have all of the skill sets and because then you end up with a jack of all trades, master of none. Mm-hmm. And I've, as I've said to clients and numerous times when they've asked me certain questions and different topics, I say, I'll have to get back to you on that because I hire people smarter than me to know things like that. but in terms of your design education is about learning about design thinking and problem solving. It's also about a very broad-based education. Design education is not learning how to use Photoshop, Illustrator, and InDesign. When I went to design school, it was very different in a lot of ways than the design schools now. It would certainly change in terms of, I went to York, and the York is now a York Sheridan program. It's very different. We did not have, it was a four-year program. We did not have a single course in that 4 years that taught us anything about software. Hmm. We had computers in the design lab. We had a person who ran the design lab and people who assisted in the design lab. How we learned our software is we had projects that we needed to use those specific pieces of software to do. So we learned the software in the context of doing a project. There was never a course in the software. All of our courses were in different levels and challenges, problem solving. And even some of our design projects you wouldn't even recognize as a design project. There was one, you know, pick a problem in the world and how you might solve it. Like a challenge, you know, whether it's whatever was going on at the time. So the other thing we were encouraged to do was to have a very broad-based education. This is why I'm a big believer in university-based design education. Is what's really important is, you know, your history, your geography, your English, your psychology, philosophy, astronomy, all of that. In terms of having a wide perspective from an educational standpoint. And just be curious about things and think about things when you're faced with a design challenge. Always ask the question of why the person is asking you to solve this problem. And try to dig into that a little bit. It really is about keeping yourself open in terms of your perspective and being very curious about the things that are happening in the world around you and the different opportunities out there and the different ways to solve challenges and problems and also build a network of people that have different focuses and areas of expertise. And that's how we built our firm, is there's not that many what you would call straight designers in our firm. It's actually a relatively small group. There's a lot of As I said, you know, there's motion graphics. I guess you could put architecture and industrial design under designer, but what I'm talking about is graphic designer. Like if you went to York Sheridan or OCAD or something like that, there's not that many. You know, you have a lot of technical people. You have the industrial architecture. You have some strategy. You have motion graphics. So all of that, but they all are, there's still a strong creativity. There's still a problem solving in terms of the, you know, presented with a challenge. Now, how do I use the tools that I understand to solve this? So just coming back to your original question, it really comes from an open perspective and really thinking about the core of the problem and opening your mind and thinking laterally of how you can solve this problem in different ways that isn't necessarily along the lines of the medium or the application you initially think of. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes tons of sense. To the extent that you can you share with us a bit about projects that you've either completed recently or are working on right now at Forge?
Without getting into specific names, we've got something very exciting happening with a major hotel that we're developing a completely integrated static and digital, so working with physical signage and digital signage for a major conference center in a hotel, where it is going to provide a highly intelligent real-time wayfinding system, which is driven by the events that are happening in the rooms. And essentially, when you walk in, you'll be presented with both information in terms of what events are happening at that time. It will lead you to the pathway to find those events, and there'll be a series of mix between physical and digital. As you follow your path, it'll lead you to the vertical circulation. From the vertical circulation, it'll lead you to the room. So the wayfinding is entirely event-based. The really exciting thing about it is it's entirely dynamic. So as events change, as different times, all of that, the wayfinding is actually going to change. So it uses this really responsive, dynamic breadcrumb approach that leads you to your destination, and from your destination to other destinations, from the destination out of the conference center. So instead of coming in and having an interactive map to try to find your way and then remember your pathway, which can work in some environments. In this environment, it is incredibly complex. So in this environment, we are taking a different approach where we're not using maps at all, and we're simply using the information that people, they know they need to get to this, you know, welcome breakfast or whatever, and guiding them to that. But as soon as the destination they're seeking changes, the wayfinding's actually going to change to match that. So that one's pretty exciting.
Sounds very promising.
Yeah, it's we only know of one other place in the U.S. where a similar system's been done. It was much larger scale, though. It was a huge conference center. A little bit differently. So this is definitely going to be one of a kind in Toronto, that's for sure. And very, very almost one of a kind in North America in terms of how it's going to function. So we're pretty excited about that one. We're doing a major hospital in the US, mobile based wayfinding, 3 million square feet of the hospital. It's not even the whole hospital. It's just two buildings. It's really big. We're developing mobile-based wayfinding, but again, our perspective and approach is not to have people wandering the hospital hallways staring down at their screen. What we want the mobile wayfinding to do is be essentially a touch point and to work with landmarks and points of orientation that are also in the physical space, but to more to just, you know, when people are where they are and they're trying to find their destination, that they can use it as a bit of a quick orientation as opposed to, you know, follow the dot. So that's pretty exciting. We're doing an airport in the US, which is map-based wayfinding. And we're doing probably our highest profile project also in the US. We do a lot of work in the US. Is we're developing the program for the signage, sorry, the wayfinding and signage and the brand for the building as well. For the, I can give you the name on this one, the Comcast Technology Innovation Center in Philadelphia, which is actually being designed by Norman Foster himself.
Wow.
Yeah, that one's pretty exciting, and it's got Four Seasons on the top of it, and it's a very, very ambitious project, which is essentially at a creative campus. It's an office tower that's not really an office tower. It's a vertical creative campus in downtown Philadelphia. And we're exploring the concept there of data-driven design, where the coordinates and the relationship of where you are in the building actually drives the shape to a certain extent of the sign, how that can integrate with the architecture. So because it is Comcast and the idea of data and how data can offer orientation in itself, we're exploring some of those ideas. So that's pretty exciting.
So if people want to find out more about Forge Media and Design, where can they go?
ForgeMedia.ca. We're going to be launching a new website very, very soon, probably within the next couple of weeks or so.
Okay.
We've been working on it for a while. We've had a bit of a challenge of the cobbler's shoes, where we just haven't had time to do our own. Because our current site was done a long time ago and doesn't really reflect what we would feel is a strong example of web-based user experience. But our new site will, and we'll show some of our newer projects, and it will be a much better reflection of who we are. So, but yeah, forgemedia.ca is the best place to look at what we're doing. There'll also be a link to our public blog, which has some interesting information on it as well.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
All right, thank you for the opportunity.